I'm going to talk now about engrams. What a person will do to escape his own engrams after having made them is one of the more wonderful studies. And so far as the mind is concerned, is the study of human behavior. Is the study of human behavior. Sounds funny, doesn't it? The whole idea of engrams is the idea of consequences of experience. Experience and its consequences. And the engram is the mechanism by which experience is confirmed, held in place, and continued. The first engram occurs when a person has ceased to trust his own judgment. When his judgment is no longer trustworthy, when he feels that he cannot depend upon himself to do anything, he then depends upon experience. And he conceives methods of self-punishment, which will thereafter guide him in the path of right. Works out very easily. Works out very easily. He's in a tube station. One of the signs says, "Eat biscuits." So he very carefully, standing there in the tube station, holding himself there, apparently waiting for a train, and all of a sudden, there's a big rush of people, and they push him off the edge of the platform. He falls down on the rails, and they drag him off the rails, and they lay him out, and everybody says, stand back, don't get near him. And now he is totally devoted already to the cause of experience as my guardian, my flag, my staff. Experience will see me through. He's got an engram now, tells him what to do. Eat biscuits. Yes, experience, when it is put on automatic as a teacher, ceases to be rational. Because it doesn't think, and that is something that most people don't quite perceive. Experience doesn't do any thinking. Experience is identification. We have the whole war, then, amongst three things, actually two extremes and one mean. Differentiation, similarity, and identification. We say identification, we say ordinarily A equals A equals A equals A. Everything in the A is A. You could also say identification is A equals B equals C equals D. Maybe a more apt statement. You could also say that all experience equals all past, equals all, equals future, equals me. You'd have just about that way. Equals, equals, equals. Judgment is selective drawing of similarities and depends for its accuracy upon the ability to differentiate. And when judgment drops out, identification drops in, hangs its hat up, and stays there from there on out. Falling off a platform onto the third rail equals eat biscuits. Why? Because when he was in a pain state, semi-conscious, eyelids barely open, the only thing you could see in all this was eat biscuits, this sign on the wall. You see, eat biscuits. And yet he can't ever quite get into the engram because somebody says, stand back, stand back. Stand back. Let him have some air. Do you want to kill him? Well, the funny part of it is, after that he has to eat biscuits. But they always make him want to stand back. And he has stomach aches, because obviously biscuits are trying to kill him. But he has to have biscuits, you see. The funny part of it is they taste like iron third rails. Yes, experience is a great teacher. Anytime... Anytime we have a totality of identification, no similarity to amount to anything, and a total absence of differentiation, we have trouble, not experience. We have trouble. The fellow who gets every location in the physical universe identified at last with every location in the physical universe is at the same time totally here, wherever he is, but totally elsewhere, wherever he is. We have a technological term for this, which is buttered all over the universe. He could still differentiate between the Isle of Man and Arizona when he was sane. But when he was on the Isle of Man, walking down the hill one day, and some rocks came loose, and he tumbled down to the bottom, and the rocks all fell on top of him, and they rendered his existing body in a somewhat second-hand condition. Well, when he was in Arizona, he was walking downhill one day, and he had an engram of having fallen while walking downhill in the Isle of Man. So obviously, he now knows what to do. When you walk downhill, you find some loose stone, walk in it, fall down, and let the stone roll over on top of you. That is what you do. So he does this. Unfortunately, he already has some lack of differentiation, because what you do in Isle of Man is not necessarily what you do in Arizona. But he conceives these two areas to be similar in some fashion or another. Just why is up to his engram bank. And when he does this, however, in Arizona, he now knows that the Isle of Man is Arizona. Good going, you know. He also finds out that the time this happened in Arizona is the same time as it happened in the Isle of Man. In order to have experience, you have to disrupt your time track. It's absolutely necessary. You're in the war, and you made out ammunition requisitions in quintuplicate. Obviously, in quintuplicate, takes longer to do. Good reason. And furthermore, particularly when the enemy is advancing, the Quartermaster Corps conceived a very excellent method, supply, you know, has received a very excellent method of saving the taxpayer money. When hysterical demands for ammunition arrive, why, they know what to do. You see, they know what to do. As don't go issuing stuff that gets expended, gone at once. That's not proper. Because their experience during the war is a continuing experience of peacetime. So they have to conceive that while they're in the war, they are actually in peacetime, and therefore save and conserve government property. So they let a regiment of men be mowed down because, you see, it's very difficult to issue that amount of ammunition because everything has to be in quintuplicate and nobody can find a pink copy. Well, that's the way they did it in peacetime, so they walk into war with the same organization. Well, to have experience, you have to conceive that one period is another period. You have to apply everything that happened on one part of the time track to everything that happened on another part of the time track in order to get a proper application of experience. Somebody walks into the office, they say to this person, they say, "Do you have experience?" The person says, "Yes." Now, if their experience has been painful and violent and so on, then you say, you could say, "Well, do you have a scrambled time track?" And this would be a senseless remark to them. But nevertheless, the answer would be yes. Person says, "Well, I have experience." Well, having to have experience in the workaday world, universities, living, also adds up, of course, in the engram bank, in the reactive mind, to a total identification, finally, of date for date, so that 1762 is 1952, you see. And therefore, what happened in 1952 will follow the same pattern as whatever happened in 1762, you see. Obvious, isn't it? That anything that happened at any stage of the time track will then happen again. Now, individuals revolt against this by saying it must never happen again. And we get the second factor which jams the track. An individual says, "I can no longer trust myself. I have to have experience. Therefore, what has happened to me yesterday will guide my footsteps today." Simple, isn't it? Nice, interesting, easy mechanism. He's already made up his mind now to take yesterday and to live today better and happier and more carefree. Obvious. "Yesterday, when I got up in the morning, I started singing at the top of my voice. It made the little woman mad. We had a dreadful breakfast." It's obviously. "When I get up this morning, why, I won't let it happen again. You see, and I'll have a nice breakfast, and we'll have a nice pleasant morning, and go sailing happily upon our way." So, a fella gets up in the morning, next morning, guided by the experience of yesterday, and doesn't sing. Doesn't say a word. He goes around very quietly. Okay, gets on. Hello. Finally, his wife, being a delicate, well-mannered lady, says, "What the hell are you being so quiet about? What have you been up to?" See, the system didn't work. So the third morning, he gets up and he says, "Now let's see. 2 days ago, I sang and was happy and practically a canary bird here. And that started a fight. And yesterday, I was silent. And that started a fight. Huh. Where do I go from here?" Well, there isn't any place to go from there, of course. So he relies on deeper experience. Now, this, of course, he can't make up his own mind, so he turns on an automatic mind-maker-upper. Hey. So he gets mad as hell, and he beats the devil out of her. Nothing happened the third morning at all. Instead of singing, instead of being quiet, he simply walks in and knocks her over the head. The only trouble is, operating somewhat analytically, the wife by this time has gotten a guilty conscience. And on the first morning, why, she had a splitting headache. And headaches are always splitting for some reason or other. I don't think it has anything to do with old executions or anything like that. But she objected, you see, to all of this noise and racket. Next morning, why, she had a guilty conscience about it all. And she said to herself, well, I've been trying to make him happy and so forth, and now I've crushed him down, and he's going around trying to show me now, by being very quiet, that I have done wrong, and he is reproving me. He is being resentful. He is being sullen. Right? So she gets mad at him for being sullen. But then experience has told her that two mornings in a row, she got involved in a fight. So on the third morning, she analytically decides to relax about it all. And if he sings, he sings. And if he's quiet, he's quiet. The thing to do is to give him a good breakfast and cheer him up and send him on his way. He walks in and hits her over the head. Well, this doesn't add up. Doesn't add up to her. Now, without saying anything about it, the intention of being nice to her husband has been greeted by being beaten. He has now the experience of being nice to the wife and being thoughtful and considerate. Gets him no place either. So they both settle down in a mutual engram called marriage. And from there on, they're human. She has no more answers. He has no more answers. So he acts like his father or his mother, whichever was the handiest series of engrams, and she acts like her father or her mother, whichever is handiest in her engram bank. And these just go into action, and they all automatically carry out somehow or another. Only sometimes it doesn't work out because both of them elected to be their fathers. You have the behavior pattern of two fathers trying to live together. Difficult. Now, an individual probably could get along all right and probably would never use an engram bank if it weren't for the third dynamic. Trying to withhold. Trying to get along. Trying to understand. Trying to negotiate this stormy sea called social or human relations. You'd probably get along all right. But he's up against an understandingness more or less comparable to his own, and actually on the third dynamic, many understandingnesses comparable to his own, and the interrelationship and interlock of these various dynamics are all of them additive into a problem the complexity of which defies all computation. Now, you could say the ingredient of trying to make everybody happy is the root of all evil. It's a rather pathetic thing, by the way, that when you get misbehavior on the second dynamic in the marriage, where the husband is getting angry at the wife and the wife's getting angry at the husband and so on, that it's actually all tangled up from one source. They're trying to make each other happy. And they're trying to live on that dynamic with a deleted first. If you inquire into why somebody got mad in life, it's an interesting commentary on man, commentary on his decency, his validity, his sincerity. He was trying to do something for somebody, and they didn't understand and didn't accept it. His answer to that is to get mad at the person he was trying to help. That's a second reaction. Misemotion is always secondary to primary emotion. Upset is always secondary to order. chaos is always secondary to order. The first postulate is order. The second postulate is chaos. So, person falls very easily into this pattern. Next time somebody's mad as the devil at you, you can't seem to put your finger on it. Be an auditor for a few minutes. Try to find out something. What was that person trying to do? What was that person trying to do for you? You don't nearly always find out they're trying to do something which has been dismayed and kicked in the head. It's quite amazing. It takes a lot of fast communication, very quick understanding, to follow one of these things down, because the impulses go by rather rapidly. Wife's out late, comes home, gets dinner late. Husband comes in, says, "What's dinner late for?" He's not mad. He just wants to know. She gets mad at him. She snaps at him. Why was dinner late? She was probably out trying to find something that he liked, and she couldn't find it. And this upset her because she couldn't buy this thing and deliver it up. And dinner got late, too. And a kind action on her part has been dismayed. Of course, logically, she should then get mad at him. Basically, he's the cause of it, isn't he? You just get a deteriorated cause, that's all. But the primary impulse is generally, I think you could look for a very long time without finding that the primary impulse was kindness. An effort to help, an impulse to assist. And misemotion, upset, destructive considerations and actions pursue from the refusal of something to be helped. Now, a crude example of it is a fellow fixes a clock, tries to fix a clock. Didn't work. So he takes it apart, puts it back together again, fixes it again. It didn't work. So he takes it apart, and he fixes it again, and it doesn't run. Well, that's how that scar got on the wall. He's balked or dismayed. So we get back to the basic intention, impulse of. The basic intention is to help, to assist, to be kind, to remain in communication, so forth. These are all basic intentions. If you would understand man, all you have to understand really is that his basic intention was good and has been dismayed. You could say about any warlike nation that has started to get mad at all of its neighbors, that their basic intention, their former intention, prior intention, was to assist their neighbors. And every time they tried, they got in trouble. But this is merely a dismayed postulate. It is a postulate that has been refused. It is a postulate that isn't valid. Well, an individual keeps on trying to do something and having it fail. And he tries to do it, and he has it fail. And he tries to do it, and he has it fail. And after a while, he has an area of postulate, you might say, a statement, consideration that he do this thing, that is now an inflow area. He can't outflow from that area. Every time he tries to do something from that point, he thinks he will now be dismayed. So his answer to it is to destroy anything which might possibly be in that area, because it has been proven to him conclusively he can't help it. If he can't assist it, then it's in such dire straits that the last final way to assist it is to blow it up. And that, oddly enough, is help, too. Euthanasia, mercy killing, and so forth, all stems from that sort of consideration. Satan's last impulse when he sees somebody dying or something like that is to kill him quick, save him suffering, square him around, you know. Now, when an individual's impulses have been thoroughly, consistently, and continually dismayed, he decides he can no longer emanate from a certain point on a certain subject. In other words, he can't stand there talking to his wife saying nice things. Get the idea? This can't be done. So one of his first efforts is to put something else there and to confront with. He confronts the wife with something else, and it's very handy, and experience tells him that the best person with which to confront a wife was, and he'll pick some quasi-successful valence. See, his grandfather could always handle women. He no longer confronts his wife. He puts up, you might say, a mock-up to confront the wife with. Those people who feel different when they are suddenly around their own home or around the wife or the husband or something, they're out in the street, they feel okay, everything's going along, they're talking with their companions, they're people at work and so on, why they're just this way or that way and shifting around and feel rather free. And then they suddenly get home and they feel like somebody else, a different mood comes over them. They're actually merely using this mechanism of confronting with. And there was somebody, somewhere, that could confront a marital partner. And judgment is always, to some degree, apparent, even in the use of engrams. Even in the use of engrams, there's an apparency of some judgment. Because they pick a clumsy choice, usually, but they will pick the winning valence. Well, that winning valence might not itself have had too much to recommend it elsewhere, but it certainly could confront a wife. Got the idea? So they picked this winning valence. All right. Now, let's look at engrams again. A Thetan is trying to win. Right on down the line, he's always trying to win. His idea of succumb, for instance, is just for further survive. Future survival depends on his succumbing now. He who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. This is one of his basic tactics. So what he does, he takes an engram, and he takes that valence in the engram which could confront the thing, and when he no longer feels that he can confront anything like that, he wears the valence that can confront it, and he confronts it unthinkingly on the exact pattern that that valence confronted it. Now, when he is that valence, that new valence, that being, isn't alive, is he? Let's look this over. He has a picture of a nurse. If he is being that nurse in the picture, he's not being himself, is he? Well, the person who is himself is alive, but the nurse is simply a series of habit patterns or something like that that he himself re-stimulates. The nurse to that degree isn't alive. The nurse really isn't a living being. You see? Sickness. Sickness. He can't confront sickness. He's never been able to confront sickness. This is one thing that he can't stand. Himself, personally. Well, what's the obvious answer? That's to pick up a packaged personality that he has observed in a moment of sickness and duress as being highly successful. Well, he's already said that to pick up somebody else, he himself couldn't confront it or do it. Follow this? See, he's already said, just by picking up somebody else to do the confronting, he's already said that he himself couldn't do it. So, on an automaticity, he picks up people who could confront sickness while he himself was sick. He was the least able in the scene to confront sickness. So when he tries to confront Annabelle's illness, it's very easy for him to become his own nurse in his own illness area and be that nurse to Annabelle. Got the idea? Annabelle can handle sickness. Annabelle's a winner. He's not, but the only times Annabelle has been around is when he's been sick. So we have this fellow move out of his own beingness into the beingness of Annabelle, and then one day somebody tells him he's a bad nurse, or he gets a contradiction of some sort, and they shift him back into, quote, his own valence. Well, now, wait a minute. He was sick in that valence, wasn't he? Well, he'll get sick right then. This is Nietzsche, please. In other words, he got the engram basically because he doubted his own ability to handle and confront situations in life. So now he got a package of experience which will tell him and give him the answers. And now out of that package of experience, he selects beings who can confront the things he found he was unable to confront. He wears this like somebody'd wear a hat or a coat. He wears this. And wearing it, he's also wearing the area where he was the least. Now somebody comes along and, quote, breaks his dramatization, unquote. He's really dramatizing an engram. He's going through the motions, statements, habits, reactions of a nurse during his own illness in order to treat people, you see? Now, somebody comes along and convinces him he's no good, he can't heal, he's up the spout. And because he's parked in an area of track and he has this all beautifully arranged, he slides into his own sickness valence. And there he is. Now, there's value to being sick. People are nice to you. They don't beat you, generally. It's quite seldom that they beat sick people in this society at this time. But lots of societies, if you got sick, they beat you. Their experience doesn't compute, does it? So this individual decides the best thing to do in order to get along, whenever sickness appears, is to be Annabelle the nurse. Then somebody comes along and convinces him that he can't be Annabelle the nurse, so he slips over into his own valence. So now the new answer is, the way to handle sickness is be sick. Very simple, isn't it? It has added bonuses. People are nice to you when you're sick. People aren't mean to you when you're sick. One day he's feeling like hell, and somebody says, what you being sick for? So he says, well, I'm sick quite a bit of the time, he says pathetically. You know, that's the way to handle a situation. I'm sick quite a bit of the time. Guy says, okay, you're fired. Now he can't be sick. Now this valence has been invalidated, isn't it? So he now goes searching for safe valences, not valences that can get anything done or that can confront or not confront or handle a situation. He's looking for a null. He's looking for one that is safe, one that neither handles the situation nor is handled by the situation. And we get an old-style process. Invent an individuality that could cope with it. And people will go through these valence patterns, one kind or another, and pick them up. But he's looking for a safe valence. He looks for something that is totally safe to be. And experience tells him what these are. And he uses experience to establish this. A brass idol's a safe thing to be. You have a lot of people sitting around these days in coffee houses and so forth being brass idols. It's quite remarkable. They look like them. They act like them. They haven't much to say. They're very wise. I can usually spot them. I usually, if I'm talking with them, I ask them for an oracular utterance, and they always give them to me. People just don't recognize them, you know. You have to be able to look to know about beings. Somebody can show you a few things around, but you from there on have to look yourself. You walk up to this fellow, and he's sitting there bodhistically regarding his navel or something of the sort in the coffee shop. And he's a little bit displaced. Several centuries and a couple of continents. But that's nothing for the Engram Bank, you see. That's just nothing. That's almost accurate. Maybe sitting there. I walked up to such a chap and said, "Well, what'll my day be like tomorrow?" And the fellow'd look up, you know, and say, "Well, you will wake up in the morning and you should be on guard for evil intentions and thoughts. And you will withal have a successful day. You won't die for years and go back eating his fish and chips." And his companions look, and they've never heard him talk like this, say anything like this, or act like this before in their knowledge. In other words, you just hit their being right square on the button, bang. You ask them to do exactly what the engram does, and they'll do it. It's quite an amusing thing. It requires a considerably perceptive eye. You can hit this very well. I can walk up to any nurse practically in a hospital who is active, not the sick nurses. They're in patient valences. But somebody who's being very active and rather regal in manner, and that's almost any one of them that's really in there cooking, as you walk down the line, and you say, "How is the patient doing today, doctor?" They'll say, "Well, he's doing... what are you talking about?" These things will trigger. The funny part of it is, because they are there for you to confront, these valences and pictures inside the pictures obey you better than they obey the person. It's quite amazing. An individual has a hard time sliding out of these valences. But you don't have a hard time. You just tell him, get out of them. He'll move right out of them. He can't help himself. They obey the environment because environment was the teacher. They obey the other person because they were set up to cope with other people. So a Scientologist is in the rather amazing position of being able to command these engrams and their internal pictures and mechanisms much better than the person who is inhabiting them. You can make these things do almost anything you want. But because you have a thing on invasion of privacy, you think there's some privacy around and you don't invade it. I well remember a very famous auditor receiving a horrible lesson one day. He got a horrible lesson. Quite remarkable. He'd been going along for years, beating the drum for people's self-determinism. Everyone should be self-determined. Everyone should be self-determined. You mustn't interfere with people's self-determinism. Whatever they do is right because that's their self-determinism. He'd been going along on this kick for a very long time, and therefore being careful not to invade anybody's privacy. So, before that time, he wasn't a famous auditor. He's gotten to be one since. And it works like this. Somebody asked him why he wasn't handling a school teacher. And he said, "Well, she's got to work it out for herself. After all, she is the principal or the sub-principal of a number of teachers, and she has her own life to lead. And one must not interfere with her self-determinism." Well, the fellow put him into an auditing session, banged him out of his head, banged him somewhere into the vicinity of this teacher, got him to take a look, got him to inspect the whole thing, got it all squared around, and he came back with a horribly startled, dismayed, disillusioned look on his face. This auditor said, "What self-determinism?" You cannot override something which isn't. Most self-determinism, when it expresses itself as vicious willfulness, selfishness, greed, and other things, is simply engram determinism. It's the determinism in some picture in the reactive bank which the individual has picked up in which he is living. And that determinism isn't self-determinism, let me assure you. It's other determinism. And unless you overthrow the individual's other determinism and get him back to real self-determinism, he doesn't have any. So you can just forget about this invasion of privacy where most people are concerned. And you can move their banks around whichever way they seem to go. I'll tell you that you moving their banks around is usually better than the environment because you move them around with some judgment. And even if you use the judgment of trying to give them an awful headache or making them sick at their stomach, that's still more judgment than has ever before been applied to that bank, and it'll be better for it. Quite interesting. The individual says, I am not. And his idea and desire to be in the game, his idea of livingness, will not permit him to say, nothing is. Somehow or another, he can't permit himself to say nothing is. If he said, I am not, and was then happy with it, this would be one thing. But he doesn't. He says, I am not, and I must be. He's trying to stay in the game, but he can't confront it himself anymore, so he's confronting it as something else, and as somebody else. The funny part of it is, the horrible joke is, nothing he gets to confront for him is more able to confront than he is. Anything he gets to confront for him is less able to confront than he is. He has to find this out again. If he's confronting sickness as a nurse, he just has an idea that he can't, a nurse can. And therefore, if he is a nurse, why, he gets sickness confronted. What he doesn't realize, that even as a nurse, he is himself confronting sickness. And he's doing it on such a thorough via that he can't make it win. And he gets into trouble with it. It's not a very successful action. That moment when an individual decides he is not himself, that moment when an individual decides to deny himself, that moment when an individual decides, I am not, he then says, somebody else is for me, or something else is for me. And when he says this, he's just trying to get back in the game on covert confrontingness. He himself isn't allowed in the game anymore, he says, because he isn't. But he gets back in the game as somebody else. Now, this mechanism is more general than you think. You walk down the street and you ask a large percentage of the people. We'll give you an answer if you ask this question. Have you ever lived before this life? And a larger percentage will say, no. No, how silly. Physicists tell us from their high priest temple that man is mud, and mud becomes mud, and mud is mud. And mud doesn't live anyhow, and to live before this life, that's silly. And if you ask a religionist, have you ever lived before this life? Why, he says, He says, no, he said, all of my hopes would be wiped out, because after this life, if I am a good boy, I go to my reward. Of course, you and I know, if we know anything about the whole track and the experience of man and what he really is about and what he does, what that reward really consists of. Pie in the sky, sail of. No, his living cyclically, life to life, is simply explained by the fact that when he gets killed in one life, he has had it proven to him conclusively, that he, as that person, he's already living on a via, he, as that person, no longer has any right to exist, so he must not be that person anymore at all, so he has to pick up another being to be a new person. So he lives that life, and he gets invalidated by getting killed at the end of that life, or dying, or something. And so he has to be another person now, so he comes along, and of course, every time you walk into him, you ask him, have you ever lived before? Oh, no, not me, you know. What are you trying to trap me into, you know? You trying to trap me and take some responsibility for all this? Oh, not me. What do you mean, people have lived before? What are you trying to talk about, past lives? This is nonsense. This is utter bosh. Utter bosh. Of course, it serves them right when you, well understanding you have better control of their engram bank than they do, simply say, the picture of you being a caveman will now go into restimulation, you know. They say you're a hypnotist. You've caused something now that didn't exist. He stands there going, hum, 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 hum. Quite amazing. Now, the engram then does have a purpose and does fulfill a function. And its function is covert confronting. We see this quite a bit. If you will notice, as you look around the streets, you will see a poor carbon copy of many movie stars. Did you ever notice this oddity? Well, people pick up their valences rather easily and stack them in. Now, it wasn't necessary for the person to have a moment of physical pain and unconsciousness to then pick up the valence of this movie star, you see. All he had to do was go to a movie, and they felt kind of sick, and they were a little bit tired, and they're looking at the screen sort of fixedly, or they've had an operation in the last few days. And this becomes part of a physical pain experience, you see. They just hook it onto the end, hook it into place, move into the valence, and after that, go around Humphrey Bogarting everybody. It's quite amazing. Quite amazing. You let somebody into a high school play, and he plays the role of a petty thief. But he's tremendously successful in this role as a petty thief. Everybody says, didn't you do well, you know, and so on. Well, boy, never up to that time has he had a successful beingness. He's been that Joe, you know, and nobody's paid attention to him at all. But there he was, and that petty thief could evidently confront a tremendous number of people very successfully. Now, because he has lots of engrams of being a petty thief, you have all kinds of assorted engrams to choose from, he generally doesn't pick up the one of the play at all. He picks up some counterpart that he used to play the part. We got a before and after the fact, you see here. When they ask him to play the role of a petty thief, he just called up the time when he was one, or something like that, of the backtrack, and he used it. Very convincing. So now it's successful. He has won with it, and he has stuck with it. Nobody can understand after that why they can't get him out of a criminal complex. Nobody's ever told him to be the play director. See, that was part of the play, too. He'd even do better as the feminine lead. You could shift him around. It's very funny. You can shift people around from one engram to the other engram, from one valence to another valence. Greatest of ease, and don't think the environment doesn't do it. These sudden changes people experience sometimes, sudden physiological changes, sudden illnesses, sudden onsets, so forth, they've just shifted in their position in the time span of the reactive mind and shifted in their position with regard to personnel contained therein. And they shift in these positions, and they become somebody else, and so forth. Scientology, we try to reestablish the individual's power of choice over his own beingness, because he has forgotten that he can be himself much better than he can be anybody else. He's much more familiar with the part. But the part has let him down, he feels, too many times. He's lost too often. He's made a mess of it. Therefore, other things can confront much better than he can. And that's his obvious conclusion. The pictures which he makes and mocks up succeed after the fact of his abandonment of his own beingness. If you want to get a fellow keyed in totally, convince him he's nobody. Let him join the army or something of the sort. Convince him he's nobody. Convince him that he hasn't a chance as himself. He hasn't a prayer. Therefore, he'd better be somebody else. Second, you can get him convinced that he himself hasn't a chance, or that he can be somebody else. A rather pathetic case I handled one time having to do merely with engrams and man's use of engrams and so on. A criminal was handed over to me by local police department. They sometimes shove people my way they consider utterly hopeless. And it was their consideration that this man was a homicidal maniac. But because he had never actually killed somebody that they had any record of, they felt he might go along to a point and actually kill somebody. They felt he was quite dangerous in the society. So just out of a slight interest, something like that, they sent him over to me to see if I could do anything with him. It was a pathetic case. He'd been a little newsboy, and every time he had sold his papers, the neighborhood bully had come along and had beaten him up totally and thoroughly and had taken the remaining papers and all of his money away from him. This happened every night. He'd hit him and take his money away from him. This man totally made his living, if you want to call it that, by walking down the street or getting into a card game or getting a fellow in a hotel room or something of that sort, but preferably the street, and beating up somebody and taking away his money. Now, he had tried to stop himself from doing this by paralyzing his own arm. One day, he felt himself almost striking his mother, and he put a hold on it to such a degree that he became paralyzed. One arm was totally paralyzed, and a section of that body was paralyzed. Yet, he still had to go out and beat up people and take away their money. And this was what he had to do. I established this fact, gave him back a little bit of freedom of motion, worked this thing out, actually got the engram into view, inspected it, and so forth. I didn't give him very much auditing. I auditing him two or three times, I think, for only about an hour or so. I wanted to find out about the case. I was doing an analysis of the case, and I determined conclusively that he was not a homicidal maniac. He wasn't about to kill anybody. He was merely going to beat people up and take their money away from them. That was the only thing he was ever going to do. He had to hit them in a certain way, a certain number of times, and take a certain sum of money. Isn't this fascinating? As a little boy, he received an engram every night that he tried to sell papers. I did something toward the end of one of the sessions. I simply flipped him into his own valence, but his own valence he had never grown up as. He was a little boy, and he kind of lisped, and he couldn't talk very good, and he thought he was in a peculiar state of beingness, and so forth. And he went out and got with some of his companions and flipped back, but I didn't flip him back. The environment flipped him back. But I flipped him into his own valence. He said it was very funny. He felt much better, and so forth, but he had a feeling like he was going to be beaten up at any moment. Here was an engram walking around the streets. Here were pictures arrested in time. Here were these pictures being used in the game of livingness. You want to know what a rock is? A rock, what we call a rock, is simply that engram which immediately succeeded after the individual had decided that he himself was nothing. And is the earliest and first time that the individual decided that he himself was nothing and that something else could confront life for him better. And when he'd made that decision, he mocked up with all of the capability he had at that time and continued in existence some hard, resistive, baffling, or useful object, usually a simple geometric figure, and became that thing. After a while, of course, it failed because it wasn't as good as he was. And yet, it succeeded well enough and long enough to make him keep it around forever after. And the basis of the whole reactive mind is this one little pivot point, the rock. The first abandonment of personal beingness. The first use of other confrontingness than self. Now, that is the rock. And that is all the rock is. It's simply the crossroads, the lash-up, and the tie-together of the reactive mind. And to get the reactive mind to fly apart, get the engram chains, get the pictures to sort out, get the track in some sort of shape, and so on, is only necessary to find the rock. In Dianetics, a thing called basic was described. Well, the rock is basic. Here, 11 years after the fact, why basic has been isolated on every case. That thing is called the rock. And strange feelings come off a person when he runs into this first time he abandoned his own beingness, when he decided that he himself wasn't good enough and that he'd better be somebody else. A strange feeling runs off, the feeling that he is no one. And about his first, quote, cognition, unquote, his first belief after he begins to run the rock is that he is nobody. He has now found out what he is, nobody. And, of course, that is the bottom rung of the ladder he has now climbed up to. The recognition that he believes himself to be nobody. Now, he can go up from there and eventually regain the fact that he is somebody. It is necessary for him to get the idea that he is trustworthy, that he is confident, that he can do things himself. In order to have an engram bank disappear and stay disappeared. And that comes about when you run a rock thoroughly and run off the basic engrams adopted by the individual. Today, it is not easy to do. It's taken me a great many years to put this together so that the most early techniques of it could now be used again and the phenomena could fly out and we could look at this all over again. Nevertheless, it's possible to do these things today rather simply. Anything we know about engrams today is adequately and amply confirmed by actual observation and experience. The way not to know something about engrams, however, is to go on confronting them with something else. When you can look at them directly, straightly, find out what they are, you'll find out they are packaged experience, painful or not, which substitutes for the beingness and the thinkingness and the havingness and the doingness of the individual. Unless the individual can regain these things for himself, he will continue to be aberrated and continue to have a reactive mind. Thank you.